This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Welcome to First Edition. I'm thrilled to have National Book Award winning, multi-New York Times bestseller, and just out and out one of my favorite and most exciting authors working today, James McBride, on the show. This is a Reading Life episode where we talk about his early memories of reading, what books were important to him, how he understands the value of books in writing, and talk a little bit about what motivates him as a writer. This is all on the occasion of the publication of his new novel, The Heaven and Earth Grocery Store, which I am so happy to say is really excellent. It's complicated but fun, optimistic without being naive, and just what I love to find when I pick up a new James McBride book. So go check that out. It's available now, but maybe wait till after listening to this episode. Okay, here we go.
I read Beverly Cleary a lot when I was a kid. Yeah, just kid books. But it was good stuff. I liked it. It was an innocence to it. And those, I think that would be my first memory of reading and passages from the Bible that were, you know, force-fed to me in Sunday school. In all thy ways, acknowledge him, and he will direct thy path and that kind of business.
Me too. The Bible and then the library for me. So how would a Ramona Quimby book get into your hands? Library, family, school?
Library and family. My house was full of books. We read tons of books when I was a kid. We weren't allowed to watch television. It was either books or music. And for me, it was both, because we had a piano and we had plenty of books. And that was your only private space. When you sat down at the piano and hammered away at something, or you pulled a book up and just piled yourself into a corner beneath a pile of clothes and started reading. Early books that I really liked were William Saroyan's book, The Human Comedy, was a book that affected me a lot. It was about a kid who, if I recall correctly, it was about a kid who used to run telegrams around to deliver news to people. And in doing so, he evolved into a kind of person himself. And you saw the community in my neighborhood in Brooklyn and later in Queens where we lived. We had a community. There was a grocery store and there was dry cleaners and all that kind of stuff. And so I related to that a lot. And it also gave me a world that was better than my own, because I lived in subways and buses and taking long bus rides to school and subways all the time. And he didn't have to do that. I believe he just rode his bicycle around. And
I think that's set in the San
California
Valley of California, kind of a Steinbeckian world with you can walk down the street and farms and a certain amount of freedom. Because right. You grew up in Red Hook, right? Do I remember?
Yeah, I lived in Red Hook and then later in St. Albans, Queens. And Red Hook was projects and St. Albans was a neighborhood. Lower middle class people, working class people, I'd say.
Yeah.
It was reflective of my world, though it didn't include some of the cultural things that existed in my life. But a lot of things were similar. There were a lot of similarities between this kid and myself, thinking back, because there were a lot of things that went over his head that he still had to handle.
Yeah.
My life, everything was over my head. I didn't know nothing, man. I didn't know whether I was coming or going. I just knew that I had to go to school and I had to go to church. And when I came home, I couldn't go out to play that much. When the sun came down, I had to come in the house. And there were always books around. And I just loved it. I loved disappearing into that world. I'd slip into a closet to read. I loved to read. Even when I was as a child, my mother was always very pleased by that. Because my mother was completely into books. My mother and my stepfather were both big proponents of reading. But if you were reading a book, you know, your chances of getting into trouble or spanked, as you did earlier, would lessen greatly. Unless, of course, you just totally transgressed. I remember one time I did something wrong, and one of my brothers had a book called Great Men of Medicine. Okay. My mother marched into the living room. She was mad about something, and I cracked that book open, man. I probably was reading it upside down. But she saw the cover, her anger dropped down a couple of notches. Great Men of Medicine, because for my mother, if you were a doctor, if you wanted to become a doctor, that was like
The promised land.
The promised land, that's right.
Yeah. What did she read? Do you remember what she read, your stepfather?
He read mostly, he was a furnace fireman for the New York City Housing Authority. So he fixed furnaces, and he was into, occasionally he'd be like Popular Mechanics or something, anything involving pressure valves and pipes and fittings and steel nipples that fit on this, that, and the other tools.
Yeah.
But my mother read everything. She read the newspaper, and she loved to read books. She would, when she left for work, she'd always have a book in her hand. And she read pretty much everything, and she would recommend books for us to read. And in my house, To Kill a Mockingbird was a huge bestseller, as it were. Because we wore that book out. And The Bluest Eye, when I grew older, that was a big one. And we would recommend books to each other because my siblings read quite a bit. We all read because we weren't really allowed to watch television.
You have quite a few siblings.
Yeah, I had 11 siblings. That's and several were in college by the time I came of age. And learning and the whole thing of the, you have to go to college and it's good to read books. And so that was also part of the, it was all about books and music in my house. I think about that now, in the liberal arts being under fire in school. It's just the worst thing you could do for a young person by not giving them music, literature, history, sociology, psychology. These things, they inspire. They are the roots of creativity.
Did anything your older siblings read trickle down to aspirational read and check out what they were looking at? How did the hand-me-down or waterfall of influence happen?
That was pretty significant in my house. I think the autobiography of Malcolm X was one that made its way into my hands. To Kill a Mockingbird was another, and The Bluest Eye. Probably The Bluest Eye more than any.
Yeah.
Was a book that just was worn out. We would wear books out because we someone would start reading it and slip it under the bed, and they'd go to bed and find it gone, and somebody else was reading it, and they'd get into fights about it and so forth. But I remember The Bluest Eye well, because I read that through before anybody could snatch it from me. The other books that made their way down the, I can't remember it. James Baldwin, those are the main ones that I can recall.
So once you got into school, were you a good student of reading, or you wanted to read your own thing, or how did that translate into your experience of reading in school?
It didn't translate very much. I mean, I was a good student as a youngster. But there weren't many books that I read in school that I related to. I was one of the few Black students I went to a couple of elementary schools, but the one I remember the best is in Rosedale, Queens. And there were very few Black students in that school.
Yeah.
So that wasn't a great experience for me. But when I went to junior high school, reading wasn't part of it. It was rigorous public school study, but there was no English teacher that really
lit up the fire.
I do recall I had a teacher named Miss Abdullah, who was in the second or third grade, and another teacher named Mrs. Alexander, who was, I think she was a kindergarten teacher. Miss Abdullah was, I guess she was a Muslim of some type, Middle Eastern, and Mrs. Alexander was a white woman. And I remember they told my mother that James is really smart. I don't know if reading had anything to do with that. And I don't know if that's what they said. But we had to do writing assignments, and we had to do written assignments in school. And I was good at those things because I read a lot of books. And I went to the library. We were allowed to go to the library. Mm-hmm. The New York Public Library was just... In fact, I wrote a little bit of The Color of Water in the Brooklyn Public Library.
Is that right?
When I was working on it, yeah. Because I used to play baseball in Prospect Park. This is before yuppified Brooklyn, when Prospect Park was like, people would smoke a joint there and nobody would get mad. And sometimes I'd tip over to the Brooklyn Public Library with a yellow legal pad and write down some ideas and stroll through the neighborhood, because my mother had lived in that neighborhood when she was a young woman. But libraries are, they are the fortresses of freedom. And they were that way for me.
If your mom came in your room and you were reading, is there anything you could have been reading that she would have said,
I'm sure there were, but she wouldn't find out about it.
Okay.
I don't know that the autobiography of Malcolm X was a popular book in her mind. Probably it was.
Okay. Probably.
But my siblings read it anyway and passed it around to each other. They read books about like Jim Brown and Muhammad Ali and that kind of stuff. My mother wasn't into that too much, not because she didn't like, again, my mother was a white woman raising Black kids in New York. It wasn't like she was against that stuff. She just wanted her kids to do well. Anything that got in the way of that, she was totally against. There weren't any books that were forbidden or verboten in my house. And we didn't live in an era now, like we're now where some of our major politicians or would-be presidents are yelling and screaming about. We lived in a time when we were informed that the Nazis would take books, pile them up in the street, and burn them.
And that was bad. And that was a bad thing.
Yeah, that was considered bad. So now that's considered healthy? Give me a break. I wish people would wake up to where we are. This is serious business. When one or two knuckleheads can go to a school board meeting and raise their hand and say, I object to this because of my religion. It's just a bunch of nonsense. The older I get, the more I think the religion, some elements of religion are just too much.
In the new book, especially, trying to figure out how religion connects and doesn't connect and what's useful and what's not useful.
You have to decide in your own life where you're using God as a baseball bat as opposed to what he or she is really about. That's a personal choice. When you fold that into religion and try to make it principle or law, you're making a mistake. And ultimately, it's going to backfire and hurt not just other people. It's going to hurt you, too. So in this current book, I roll out all sorts of religious business. But I present it within the framework of a society and with the framework of a people who are not sure what to keep and not sure what to keep behind, what to leave behind. And the discourse is healthy. It's when you make a choice that you're going to keep something by God. This is how it's going to go, you know, because God said it. Look, if God's so busy, how come he ain't here? What if you go to heaven and God's a cyclops with one eye in the middle of his head? And he's a man with female genitalia. What do you do then? Nobody's come back to tell us. So enough already. It's about knowledge and about celebrating the good things in every religion, because all the good things are the same. So let's work with that.
Everyone who does what we do or cares about what we care about has this on their minds. And I don't know they can beat the drum loud enough still.
I don't think you can. I think you have to. I think you're forced to. And if you're going to do it, then just ball your fist up and swing it as hard as you can. Because this is important. It's about free thought. And that's what democracy is. That's the principal element of democracy. Free thought, free speech, real talk, real discourse. Not someone angling for power by pressing your buttons. If your buttons are so fragile and they're so clear that someone can press them like that, then you need to examine your internal organs and see what's going on.
It matters that a kid has access to something, because if their parents don't give them something, they want to find it in some other way, you know, because not everyone has parents that's going to, or sibling that's going to have books around and say it's cool and fine. The other river in your, or the other tributary in your river seems like is music, right? And music doesn't get banned so much as defunded in public schools. That's how music gets banned in public schools. It gets defunded.
That's true. And what has happened with music is that there's so much quote unquote product that gets pushed into the world as a result of the internet and YouTube and so forth and TikTok and whatever, that you don't know what's good.
Yeah.
And school is the place where you can actually delineate you can see what's good and what's not, what's worthy and what's not. I mean, there's nothing wrong with a kid who grows up loving hip hop music, understanding that the third violin part of a Mozart piece makes, if you pull it out and play it by itself, it makes perfect sense. There's no difference for me between the third violin part of a Mozart concerto and the bass part to John Coltrane's Love Supreme or Tupac Shakur's latest, one of his great hits, minus the profanity. Mm-hmm. It's art. And art inspires thought and creativity. And that's what makes this nation a great one. The ability to, our willingness to allow young people to think freely and to be creative. And you can't do that by pigeonholing young people into corners and saying, you can't read this because it'll give you these thoughts. They're going to have the thoughts anyway. All you need to do is pick up a cell phone. You can pick up a cell phone now and get all the pornography you want when you're 10 years old. So what are you worrying about this? It's just it's crap. It's nonsense. It's just power mongering. It's just shoving people's thoughts down an alley, hoping that little Heather or little Rufus or little Johnny are not going to get the wrong idea. They're going to get the wrong idea. And you have to be good enough parent or a good enough teacher, or a good enough administrator, or a good enough community say, what we have here is stronger. It's better. Go ahead and read that stuff. It's not going to kill you. I think they should make high school kids in this country take a year off after they finish high school and serve somewhere. It would help. We wouldn't even have this debate. If our young people had to serve a year overseas building wells in Peru or helping villages build roads in Zimbabwe somewhere. We wouldn't even be having these debates because the humanity of others would be made clear to our children. But since we don't have that, we have to bring it to them in the form of books. So they can build as many walls as they want. It's not going to stop. It won't stop books from being read. It'll only make them more precious to those of us who understand what they have.
Trying to contain the uncontainable is a losing proposition.
Waste of time.
This episode is sponsored by The One That Got Away with Murder by Trish Lundy. Robbie and Trevor Cressmont have enough wealth to ensure they'll never be found guilty of any wrongdoing, even if everyone believes they're behind the deaths of their ex-girlfriends. Let us all take a collective angry sigh at that. Lauren O'Brien, the new girl at school, has a dark past of her own, and she's desperate for a fresh start. Except when she starts a relationship with Robbie, her chance is put in jeopardy. During what's meant to be their last weekend together, Lauren stumbles across evidence that might just implicate Robbie. And after a third death rocks the town, she must decide whether to end things with Robbie or risk becoming another cautionary tale. This is an edge-of-your-seat YA thriller that's perfect for fans of Karen McManus and Holly Jackson. Make sure you pick that up now wherever books are sold. And thank you once again to The One That Got Away with Murder by Trish Lundy for sponsoring today's show.
Today's episode is brought to you by Underlined. Haven't read a Natasha Preston thriller yet? We dare you to try. She's known for her line of chilling young adult suspense novels like The Cellar and The Fear. The New York Times and USA Today bestselling author excels at putting fear into the hearts of her readers. So her newest book, titled The Dare, is about five friends whose senior prank goes very, very wrong. This is the perfect graduation season read for thriller fans who can handle a good scare. The Dare is now available wherever books are sold. You can learn more about it at getunderlined.com. So again, this young adult thriller is about five friends with a prank that goes wrong. There are dark secrets, a twisty plot, and creepy I Know What You Did Last Summer vibes. So if you know, it's graduation season, you want to revel in that, but like make it scary, you know what I mean? Pick up The Dare by Natasha Preston, and thanks again to Underline for sponsoring this episode.
So public school in New York, he didn't get a lot of inspiration necessarily. Doesn't sound like through high school, even anything in high school that strikes.
No, and you have to remember in high school, I basically dropped out for a while. And I always read comic books though. Even when my weed smoking.
What were your favorite comics?
All of them. Well, I was a big Spider-Man guy. And I'm sorry that it's just been watered down into 18 different versions.
Well, you were in Queens, so of course you were Spider-Man.
Yeah, and I love Spider-Man. I thought he was great. And the Hulk, the Incredible Hulk. He was a big deal in my house. And I think back, the whole business of identity powered a lot of my work. And I look back, the whole business of Hulk being this mild-mannered scientist named Bruce Banner, and then he would, when he got angry, and Spider-Man being a kid that nobody pays attention to, they make fun of him at the paper and so forth, was attractive. So even in my heavy weed-smoking dropout high school days, I always read comic books.
You go spin the rack at the drugstore? How would you pick?
How would I get them?
Yeah.
Jeez, man, I'm ashamed to say it. Sometimes my brothers would have some laying around. Sometimes I'd buy them, and sometimes I would lift them out of drugstores or wherever I could find them. They were expensive to me at the time. And they also had all these ads at the back that were great. Like you'd buy fish, that like seahorses.
I always wanted to buy sea monkeys.
Yeah, you know, they would come to life, but I never did it.
No, never did it. Dakota rings, x-ray glasses, all that kind
of stuff. X-ray glasses was big. I always wanted to try those too. But it never really worked. It never really worked out for me. But I wasn't a Superman fan. I was a big Spider-Man guy. And I fell in love with Edgar Allan Poe for a while. The Telltale Heart, Unto the Death with that great agony. And later on, I realized that and also E.L. Doctorow. I was a big fan of his work. Ragtime. Also Henrik Ibsen, who wrote a play called Wojciech. I read that in college. And Carl Sandburg's Abraham Lincoln books. He had, I think there were two big volumes.
Yeah.
And when I became a little more sophisticated, when I learned about history in school, and when I got to college, started getting a little more interested in history and books about people that I admired.
Yeah. So you've been doing all this reading from the time you're a kid. What did you have any inkling that you wanted to give your hand, you try your hand at it? Like, when did that start happening?
I had no desire to be a writer. What happened was when I went to Oberlin, I wasn't quite up to the same academic level that the school demanded. And they had, I don't know, 10 or 12 of us in a special class that we had to learn how to study and all this. That Oberlin was a great man. Thank God for Oberlin. But anyway, I had to take some kind of English writing course. And the professor's name was Tom Taylor. And I had to write an essay about something. And I wrote this essay, a story about this guy who, like, he's a bad man. And he goes into the bathroom and he has a flashback of some wrong that he'd done while he's sitting on the toilet. And he collapses and he dies. And the story ends. and Professor Tom Taylor, who I later learned was like a visiting, he wasn't even like a tenured member of the faculty.
Sure, yeah, he was passing through.
He said, you have a talent for this. You have a talent for writing. You should explore that. And I was like, I don't know, man. I'm into music, man. Saxophone playing on. But I never forgot that. Really, teachers are, you talk about heroes of society. If you want to see what a society is really, look at how they treat their young people, their old people, and their teachers. Because teachers really made a huge difference in my life. I had a teacher named Mr. Green in sixth grade who heard me play the recorder and said, you have a real touch for music. And I had a teacher at Oberlin, Professor Wendell Logan in music, who taught me more about life than I can tell you here. And a teacher named Jeffrey Blodgett, who was a historic history teacher at Oberlin, who was just fantastic. I didn't, in high school, my teachers were not that involved with me. I went to Cardozo High School in Queens, but there was a guidance counselor there named Burton Silverman, who's still alive. He's 92. I still see him. And I was a troubled kid. And he used to take me into his office and talk to me. I was in a special class for truants. We all went to the same class together. So we taught each other how to shoplift and how to smoke weed. But they would send us to Mr. Silverman like once a week or something. And Mr. Silverman did something. He said something to me one day that I never forgot. I was sitting in his office and he was trying to reach me. And he kept saying, yeah, well, you're so smart, blah, blah, blah. And I was,
yeah.
And so behind him, you could see out front where I would stand with the kids who was smoking weed and stuff. He said, okay. He said, if you want to go out there with the rest of those kids, go ahead, go. Make you'll be nothing. Go ahead. He said, but it's a damn waste. What a waste. And I, at that point, 15 years old, even though I was in the morass of the teenage funk and cloud, that got through to me. I still remember it now. And so after I got out of college and became a journalist and all this, and I looked him up and I used to go to grand rounds with him when he was at Long Island Jewish Memorial Hospital working as a psychologist there. And I still see him. I saw him about 2 or 3 months ago. His son's an assistant principal at a school in Queens. Yeah, teachers have a huge effect on young people.
I mean, for most of us, it's the first time that an adult who's not related to us can say something to a kid that's, you've got something of value to offer. You know, you can play the recorder. You can play soccer, you know, you can write a little bit. And it feels different coming from someone who's not related to you.
Absolutely.
That's powerful. That's powerful.
Absolutely, yeah. The power of suggestion when you're that young and fragile and innocent is extraordinary. It's something we need to really pay more attention to.
So you wrote a story about a man who dies during a flashback on the toilet and a teacher says something nice to you. Then what?
I didn't follow up on it. I kept most of my studies at Oberlin to music. But when I became a senior, two things happened. One is that Oberlin got into this whole business of divesting its funds from South Africa. And I learned about Nelson Mandela and social change. And I got really into that. And the other thing was I took a history course from a teacher named Jeffrey Blodgett. And he walked into the room one day and he said, I'm going to tell you a story about the greatest wrestler in the history of New Salem, Illinois, He was 6'4". He had the wingspan of a basketball player. His name was Abraham Lincoln. And I just became enthralled. And so I decided to apply to graduate school for music and for journalism. And I applied to Columbia Graduate School of Journalism. I wrote an essay and I got in. I'd never written for the school paper at Oberlin or anything like that. In fact, I thought the people who wrote for the paper were brilliant. There were so many smart kids there. I owe a great deal to the school. Helped me a lot in every way. Both my sons went to Oberlin. I have a son who's a senior there now. My oldest son went there. But in any case, so I applied to Columbia. I got in. And again, I certainly wasn't at the top of my class. Columbia School of Journalism, Graduate School of Journalism
it's serious business.
Serious business, yeah. So anyway, I got through that. And then I went to Wilmington News Journal and became an intern reporter there.
Was that your idea to be a newspaper when you applied, or was your hope?
At Columbia, I thought writing would change the world. Yeah. I wanted to change the world. I was into social change. I'm going to be a journalist. I'm going to go out there and change the world. We see how that worked out. But
I guess. What if you hadn't? Could have been worse than it is now.
The dilemma was always whether it's going to be writing or music. And I didn't realize that at some point it could be both. Columbia was in New York, and this was in 1980, and New York was different then. It was a lot cheaper and a lot, I don't know. I won't say it was more dangerous or not. This whole business of New York being dangerous is ridiculous. I'm more scared in Colorado and Arizona and Mississippi than I am in the worst sections in New York. But that's a whole nother conversation. But in any case, I went there and they made us read The Power Broker by Robert Caron. Before we entered school, they sent you a letter.
Really? That's a high bar to get started.
They sent you a letter. When you got in, they sent you a letter and said, this is the book you have to read. And so I went and got it. And I was just blown away.
Was that intimidating to read The Power Broker? Like, you know, coming into your first year, were you like, shit, they're expecting me to do stuff like this?
Oh, yeah, man. I was scared. Yeah. I said, I can't do this. This guy he'd go into the guts of the New Jersey, Pennsylvania Port Authority and come up with characters. And just like his one push into one character would be a thesis in anybody. Belle Moskowitz, who was, for example, I think she was the assistant to Robert Moses or whoever Robert Moses. This guy knew how to do research. And that's what they pushed at Columbia. You have to research. You can't write unless you report. And you have to report deep. And Robert Caron was a writer who can report deep and write deep. And I've always tried to, I teach at NYU, I always push that on my students. And I also just try to do that in my own work. You can't, if you're going to report it, it better have some bone in it. Otherwise, don't pluck the meat off the carcasses because you're just plucking off dead flesh.
Your book is a memoir. And then the book since then have a deep reporting. How do you manage that kind of reading? Do you read with a plan that like, here's my syllabus for this book? Do you come with it later? Like, how does that research and reading go into the writing process?
First, every book is a little bit different, but at some point the character needs muscle, like they need a shirt, they need an arm, they need a hand. They've got to be assembled, and they can't be fully assembled unless the internal organs. And in order to learn the internal organs, you have to figure out like where this character came from. So 90% of what you learn, you don't use, but you figure it out by researching. And then this gives your character color, dimension. It gives them the mustache and eyebrow. It gives them a frame. They're framed in some sort of, and they're framed out. And then you can let them walk from one room to the next. Because if they aren't, you can let them walk from one room to the next, but it'll read like a Pulp Fiction novel.
Yeah.
It'll read like something that you buy at the train station when there's nothing else, when you got 4 hours to blow and you don't want to look at your phone. So. So I do a lot of research with my characters because I research them with the knowledge that everybody really wants the same thing. They want to be loved. They want to be happy. They want some sense of peace. They want a family. They want some kind of community. Whatever I research, I do that until I can't stand it anymore. The thing is, if you want the book to have soul, then you have to talk about this object or this person or these events as if you were there. And so you have to know them really well. And in knowing them really well, you get so that I take notes. I'm always, I have notebooks. I always I'm never far from a piece of paper and a pen. And I'm constantly taking notes, constantly gathering information all the time. I carry a little red book around all the time. Stacks of these little memo books. That I take them everywhere. I take one everywhere. If I go to the grocery store, I bring the book. So you're gathering this information. After a while, you're just like, you're full up. And when you get full up, you say, okay, I think I got enough now to push. But you have to read a lot of books. If you're working on a character and then you have to stop and research more, you haven't done it, then you didn't start out right.
So do the notes become, are they reference material? Do you go back and look at them? Or is it a process of putting it all inside and when a time comes time to write, you're drawing on it, even if you don't know you're drawing on it?
I almost never look at my notes.
Yeah.
Unfortunately. Sometimes if it's something specific. Right. But I almost never look at them. I'm just too lazy. I'm just trying to get the information in my head. Right. And I'll let the music take over.
And so it sounds like you put all this stuff in there, and then your artistic process is that flame that reduces it down to what's usable. You put all that stuff in there, but then you're reducing it down to an essence or whatever pieces make the most sense out of all the stuff you've gathered.
True, but you have to be able to scrap it all. You have to fall in love with your ideas and not your words. And otherwise you'll get jammed up. The hard part is really putting into action or realizing that, you know what, that's not going to work anyway. This current book really started out as a completely different book. I wanted to write a book about a camp that I worked at for handicapped kids for 4 summers when I was a student in college. And I wanted to, about the guy who ran it, his name was Cy Friend. He was an extremely gifted man. And he was an inspiration to all of us that worked there. The place was like a United Nations. It was very diverse. Before those words were bandied about, and Cy was gay and had to hide it. But the camp was, it was just a wonderful place. And he really believed in equality. If you didn't love those kids, you didn't last there very long. And he was brilliant. He was very insightful and just so caring and loving. And I wanted to write a book. So I started to write a book about a camp and about a camp director. And it just didn't work. I wrote several chapters. But the only chapter that seemed to hold together was this chapter about the guy who ended up giving the land to the camp. And his name was Moshe. And he was a theater owner in Potsdam.
So that's the character that remained or became the linchpin.
The original manuscript. Yeah. Moshe is the only thing that survived. All the other stuff about the camp, which happened in, you have to remember that when I wrote it as the present, or the present being 1975 or whatever, back into the, I guess, 1927, or whenever the current book starts out, I realized that the present day story was just not working. It was the past story. It was about Moshe and the way he moved around, what he thought and what he tried to do, and what his dreams were, and how crazy life was, how difficult it was, and how funny he was, and how he was thinking thoughts he shouldn't think, but they were. And then he meets this woman. It just good things connect. So I scrapped the whole camp thing, and it became a book about this theater owner whose wife runs a grocery store, and how he loved this woman and how unique she was. And then she began to take over the book, and I just went with it. And then the other things that I wanted to show in this book about the camp show themselves in the character of Dodo and the little deaf boy, and he has to go to an institution and the way they treat him and all that other business. And the love that he finds with Monkey Pants, who he meets in Penhurst, which is a real place where they had real, so-called insane people and all of that stuff. And then fusing in the whole idea of African-Americans and Jews and poor immigrants living in the same community, which happened all over this country, or at certain parts of this country anyway. That's how things connect in a book. If you just don't fall in love with your words, but fall in love with your idea, let the characters, that's the difference in novels, characters, or good novels anyway, characters rule the roost.
How hard is it to let something go like that? Was it a struggle to say, or was it so clear that the book wasn't working, made it easier to let go of, or how hard is that to do?
It's not hard for me to let go of stuff. I'm a jazz musician. When you're playing something in jazz and you're playing an idea that doesn't work, you better just get off it. Otherwise, somebody's going to get your job.
They're not going to let you sit in the next time if you're messing with something that doesn't work.
Yeah, no, we can't sit in today. Just don't get lost. So I'm not one of these people who feels like I've got to keep it because it's so precious. There's nothing. Look, the deeper story is what's precious. That you hold on to. We must get along. We must learn to like each other. Find ways to make us see the humanity in one another. That you don't lose. But everything else is just cake icing and puffing to compared to that. I know what I'm seeing now. I'm 65. And I know what I'm seeing. And what I'm seeing is struggle. And so I am, if you're about to struggle, then by God, I hope you write 100 books. But if you're not, I'm going to step right past you and move to the next thing. Because what kind of world are we leaving our kids with? Where fire starts in Canada and we can't breathe in New York. So I don't really waste too much time. If a novel doesn't want to make you change, if it doesn't want to make you be a better person, what's the point of writing it and what's the point of reading it?
Thanks so much to James McBride for stopping by. Also, thanks to Julia Rickert and Hannah Lopez at Riverhead for helping put this together. Special production assistance this week from Amanda Bacor at Book Riot. If you want to get more First Edition stuff, check out the show notes and get links to the dedicated email newsletter, Instagram, and Twitter. If you have a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts, that would be wonderful. Shoot me an email, firstedition@bookriot.com. I love feedback, love emailing back and forth with listeners. And until next time, read something great.